Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Good to see you this morning. It's delightful to be with you this morning. So nice to see many new faces in the room this morning. Welcome to all of you who are here for the first time. We're delighted that you have come to join with us in worship the Lord this morning. And the reason I say that is because it is inevitable that whenever I come to the last part of something I'm preaching on, we have new faces in the room. That's always works that way. This morning we come to part six of a multi-part series on the speech of God in Job chapters 38 to 41. And we have been working our way, as you can tell now, through this speech of God for a while because there is so much to be said here this morning. Or in the speech itself, and so it's reasonable to take some time to have looked at it. The speech itself, let me remind you, is in two parts. There's two major divisions in this sermon. The first half of it is in chapters 38 and 39, where God asks Job a series of rhetorical questions about what he has created and whether Job was involved in it. Job, were you there when I established the foundations of the world, when I spoke all things into existence? Were you there? Were you there when I made the various animals act and do and work in the way that they do? And do you have any idea of all these things? Those are all rhetorical questions that God is asking Job about whether he was involved in any of those things. And it's a demonstration, remember, of the sovereignty of God over creation. Then in the first five verses of chapter 40, right in the middle of this speech, God pauses and he puts a little interlude in there and he says to Job, now come to me and speak to me on these things now. Okay, I'm done asking you rhetorical questions. I'm now going to ask you a real one. Will you put me in the wrong? That's what God asks of Job. Will you put me in the wrong? Will you put me in a fault? Will you make me out to be a fault finder? Will you make me to be in fault because so that you can be in the right? Remember, I said that Job had, through the course of his speeches earlier in the book, accused God. Now, this is by implication, but he had accused God of being unfair or in the wrong throughout the entirety of the speech. It's unfair that I'm suffering like this. It'd been better if I'd never been born. It'd been better if this had happened or that had happened. In other words, Job struggles with the why of his circumstances. Why? Why is this? And this why causes him to waver back and forth between God being good, you know, when all is well, and then God being unfair when it's not. Sound familiar? Because it is the reality of fallen humans, the natural tendency of fallen humans to lower God and elevate ourselves. It's what we do. It's what we've been doing from the garden. We lower God to our level by either blaming him for the evil that occurs all around us, or we assert that he cannot decree suffering to be a part of our existence. So we either say, God, you're to blame for this, or we turn around and do the opposite, which is, well, you can't make suffering to be a part of my life. You're a God of love, right? So this is what Job is doing. But we know, in fact, from all of the scriptural revelation, no more vividly in Job, that God does decree for suffering to be a part of our existence. He does decree for difficulties and trials and problems to be a part of our existence. And he uses these things to bring about his good purposes. To deny him that right is to put him in the wrong. To deny him the right to decide how our lives go is to put him in the wrong. That's fundamental to where we are in the midst of this sermon. To attribute to God what is wrong, based on our opinions, right? What we think is wrong, is to impugn the character of God. It is to question God. And that's the problem here. That's been the problem of this entire book up to this point. And that's where God is going. You dare to question my purposes, my nature, my reality as God, you dare to do that? Given who you are? So now as we turn to the second half of this speech, God is going to rebuke Job for elevating himself to the position of God. He's going to rebuke him for elevating himself. Again, as I said, it's our natural tendency. Lower God, elevate ourselves, right? Even as the devil said in the garden, right? You can be like God. So God's going to come to Job and he's going to start another series of rhetorical questions regarding Job's power and position. And so while the first half of the speech involved God's sovereignty over creation, now God is going to turn his attention to God's sovereignty over man, over us. In this case, God seeks answers from Job about who Job thinks he is. Now, strangely, God will do this by comparing Job to two members of the animal kingdom. Okay, so he's going to go back to the animal kingdom again. The point being, though, is to demonstrate to Job that he has no right to think like God in the face of beings supposedly under his dominion, yet outside of his control. Thinking of yourself as God and yet not having control over the world is the point. In other words, the only sovereign is God, not man. And so now we turn to chapter 40 and we look beyond verses 1 to 5 where this little interlude occurs and we come to verse 6. And I'm sorry, verse 10. We already looked at 7, 8, 9. Verse 10. Now listen carefully to these words. This is Job. This is God speaking directly to Job. Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low, and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together, bind their faces in the world below. Then I will also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. Now, I don't know about you, but I would not want to be standing before God when I heard those words. All right? The key consideration for Job here, do you possess the power to save yourself from whatever? From whatever it is you believe you need to be saved from. All right? If we go back through this book, we have things like the physical suffering that Job endured, the reproachment that he got from his friends, you know, their idiotic logic about him just needing to appease the deity. Can you save yourself from any of that? Now, I'll have you note something in verse 14. God grants Job something. God grants Job something. I will also acknowledge to you that. Okay, so God is saying, I will acknowledge you. I am willing to give you something. I'm willing to grant that your own right hand can save you from whatever. If. Now that's the biggest word in the English language. If. First, verse 10, if you can adorn yourself with majesty and dignity, if you can clothe yourself with glory and splendor, who can do that? A God can do that. No human can do that. Oh, we try, right? Oh, we definitely try to do that. But in terms of adorning yourself with majesty and dignity and clothing yourself with glory and splendor, all right, I'll grant you something if you can do that. And secondly, if you can abase or bring low or tread down all who are proud or wicked. By the way, that word wicked is simply a synonym for the word proud in the previous verse. Can you bring low? Can you bring judgment and punishment upon all who are above you, quote unquote, as you see it? Can you bring down the mighty? Can you bring down the proud? Can you abase, bring low, bring judgment upon the proud? Can you do that? Can you adorn yourself with glory and majesty and honor and then come and make judgment over others? Can you do that? So if you can do that, if you can do that, then I will acknowledge your power and see you as you see yourself. If you can do that, I will grant that you are sovereign and I will bow to your purpose and power. It's like I said, I wouldn't want to hear those words. In other words, Job, your assertion is that you are the sovereign one, that you get to decide how things go in the world, that you get to decide how things go in your life, that you get to decide how things go in everybody else's life, and you get to decide how I, God, operate in this world. So, here's what God says. Okay, I'll play along. All right, I'll play the little game. You want to play it? God sits on his throne and he looks at humans and he says, okay, fine, I'll play your little game. You want to play this little game? Let's play it. Let's assume for a moment that you really are the sovereign king over matters of life, over matters of morality, over matters of judgment and goodness and physical health and spiritual health, and the list goes on and on. Let's imagine just for a moment that you are. Okay, I'll play the little game. If you think you're so great, fine, I'll play along. Now, let me just observe something here. This is a parenthesis right here. Human beings have a tendency to think they're all that in a bag of chips, don't they? But it is this assertion, it is this reality that separates genuine Christianity from false Christianity. Right here. This is what separates genuine Christianity from false Christianity and every other religion. Any philosophical system that pits man's power against the Creator or limits the Creator's power or banishes him entirely fails to recognize what is clear and obvious from within normal human experience. Namely, we are not gods. We control nothing. We control nothing. We are utterly at the mercy of forces beyond us. Every minute of every day, one slight alteration of even the tiniest of forces in this world would obliterate all of us. We walk around as ticking time bombs. And there is nothing that can stop the inevitable approach even of death. Can you put off the day of your death? You can try. We control nothing. We are absolutely out of control. Now, I realize it sounds very fatalistic, doesn't it? Like, whoa, this guy's whack. Why did we come to this church? But this is what genuine Christianity does. See, genuine Christianity deals with the reality. You see, all other systems of religion, all other systems even of Christianity, attempt to develop dogmas that give fallen humans the illusion of some sovereignty. That's the idea of so much of what even what we call synergism. God does his part, you do your part, and everything's going to be copacetic. But what's your part? Can you do it? Can you come and stand before God and answer this question? If you can clothe yourself with glory and honor and majesty, and if you can pass judgment on the rest of the world, then I'll acknowledge you. We have no sovereignty. So God turns to Job basically in this passage and says, okay, let's do a reality check on this whole matter of you being God. All right? Let's see if it's really true or not. See, this is where God is going. See, up before this has been, okay, were you there when I did any of these things, okay, the answer is no to all that. Okay, that gets, but this is much deeper. So he turns to two creatures to do this reality check. Now, let me read a few verses. I'm not going to read all of this section because it's redundant. But let me read a few verses just to set the mood here. Chapter 40, verse 15. Behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold his strength in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. He's the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. Now jump down to chapter 41, verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you in soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your girls? And so on. Now, we're introduced here to two creatures, one called Behemoth, one called Leviathan. The first word, Behemoth, is from the word behemoth in Greek, in Hebrew. So it's quite literally a transliteration of the original Hebrew word. And it literally means a large land herbivore. It's from the root word for a big animal, beasts, or cattle. The root word is used elsewhere for those kinds of creatures. Now, there have been many suggestions as to who this thing is, what this thing is. Suggestions include an elephant. Calvin believed it was an elephant. And by the way, in the 16th century, everybody believed that was being spoken of here was an elephant. Okay, or a hippopotamus, or some other type of grass-eating creature. Notice the end of verse 15 where it says he eats grass like an ox. So it's some sort of herbivore, some large grass-eating creature. Now, this happens to be something called a hapax legomenon, which is a word that's used only one place in Scripture. All right, so this is a word that's used only here. The root word is used in other places, but this particular variation is used only here. And so therefore, it's like, every hapax legomenon, it's like, okay, what exactly is that? Because we have nothing else to refer to anywhere else in the Bible, so we have to kind of make it up as we go. All right. So based on the description that's given that I read, it's sort of like some big creature of some sort. Now, interestingly, in the 20th century, some Christian commentators have suggested here a dinosaur. A large lizard, or what the word dinosaur means, terrible lizard, all right? So this giant creature. And that would not be far removed if you think about it from Job. If we don't believe the evolutionary explanation of dinosaurs, but believe the biblical picture, it's likely the dinosaurs were a part of the flood and then died out after the flood, after the climatological changes took place. After the flood that took place, they would die out. And so they went extinct. So it's possible that some sort of giant lizard here would be what is being referred to. All right. The second word is the word Leviathan. It's a Hebrew word I cannot pronounce, but it looks similar to it. L-I-W-Y-A-T-A-N. Leviathan. Whatever. Again, some sort of large creature, but in this case a large sea creature. Whereas Behemoth is a large land animal, this is a large sea creature. In fact, in Psalm 104:25 and following, it's used to describe a large sea creature. Here's what's interesting. The word Leviathan comes from the root word in the Hebrew for a wreath or garland. In fact, that's used that way in Proverbs 1:9 and 4:9. Same word is used to describe a wreath or a garland, which implies, in this case, some sort of sea creature that wraps itself around its prey. So some large creature that sort of wraps itself around something. Now, again, there have been many suggestions as to what this creature might be. Calvin, in the 16th century, thought it was a whale. Some have suggested a giant squid or the mythological kraken. Some have suggested some sort of massive fish or sea-going dragon of some sort, or others have simply narrowed it down to a crocodile or an alligator or something like that, a very large version. Now, interestingly enough, this word Leviathan is also used to name Satan. You find that in Isaiah 27:1. By the way, Job has made a mention already of Leviathan in this book, all the way back in chapter 3 and verse 8, you remember, where he was lamenting the fact that he was even born. He makes mention of Leviathan. I find it interesting that that's there. In ancient Ugaritic myths, Ugaritic meaning from the Mesopotamian Valley in the days prior to Abraham. When is Job? Very similar, right? Leviathan was described as a powerful dragon-like deity, an ancient symbol of monstrous horror. In Isaiah 27, which I referenced a moment ago, God is pictured destroying such a, quote, fleeing, twisting serpent, unquote. What the writer calls the dragon in the sea. And it's a metaphor in Isaiah 27 for the destruction of Satan's power over Israel as it comes from other nations that would come and oppress the people of Israel. So here are the two creatures that are introduced, Behemoth on the one hand, Leviathan on the other. And there have been a number of you who have been waiting with grand patience for me to arrive at this particular chapter, because you've all asked the same question. Who are these things? So, in my ever so humble opinion, humble, yeah, right, I am convinced that these are mythical creatures. Now, I certainly agree that God could be making reference to real creatures that existed in the days of Job. Certainly. He could be referring to creatures that were there in those days and even still exist today. Elephants, whales, alligators, whatever. Hippopotami, right? Could be. Or he could be making reference to real animals that existed in the days of Job but have since gone extinct, and therefore we don't really know what they are since they're not here. That's certainly a possibility. But I am convinced that God is actually referring to two mythical creatures known to Job as symbols of evil. Two mythical creatures known to Job as symbols of evil. And I'm going to give you several reasons why I think that. Now, the first reason is not really a reason, but just an observation. I call it reason number one, but it's really more of an observation. Isn't it interesting that we who live in a post-Enlightenment time need to know what these creatures are? Because our scientific mind says you gotta know what it is. We need to know, right? But what if God purposed for us not to know? What if God's intention is wholly to the point of saying, I don't want you to know who these are, and you'll see why as we go along. Secondly, the use of large beasts, okay, one in the land and one in the sea, seems far more metaphorical to me than actual animals, since Job is being asked if he can subdue either of them. It seems reasonable that God is using examples far beyond human power. That's the point. Can you put a fish hook in Leviathan? And the answer is no. So they seem, to me, far more metaphorical than real, given the way that God is going to use them. But the third reason is this. The connection of Leviathan to Satan by name and the place of Satan in this book seems far too coincidental to me. I'm not into coincidences, by the way. I believe that the sovereign God purposes all that comes to pass. What if God is using this word to describe the very force that is coming against Job? A spiritual force, an evil spiritual force, that cannot be tamed by men. My fourth reason is this. The use of mythological creatures suggests beings formed in the imaginations of men. Where do mythical creatures come from? They come from the imaginations of men, right? They don't exist, right? Dragons, do they exist? You like drawing dragons, right? You see dragons on movies, right? Big CG. How many times has Godzilla destroyed Tokyo now? Right? Large beings formed in human myth, which cannot be tamed or controlled. Isn't it interesting that creatures we imagine, we also imagine we can't control? Isn't that interesting? We imagine creatures like aliens or dragons or, you know, some other kraken or whatever, right? We imagine these creatures, and what happens to them? They grow up and become too big for us to control. Why is that? That's fascinating, isn't it? Maybe God here is using creatures formed in the imaginations of men in contrast to what he had created and described in detail in chapter 39. Creatures like oxen and ravens and horses and so forth, right? Which men do tame and take dominion over. What kind of creature is most outside of the control of men? Creatures created in their imaginations. But then there's a fifth reason why I think they're mythical. Is the fundamental question being raised? And what's the fundamental question being raised? Can you, O Job, judge the proud? Isn't that what he says? Look on everyone, verse 12, look on everyone who is proud and bring them low and tread down the wicked where they stand, hide them all in the dust. Do you have the power to bring down the proud? Can you control the primal force of evil in this world? And what's the primal force of evil in this world? Pride. Pride is the primal force of evil in the world. Can you bring down the forces that are centered on pride? Like Satan? What's at the heart of Satan? What's at the heart of his sinfulness? What's at the heart of the temptation that he brought to Eve? What's at the heart of all sin everywhere? The answer is pride. He implanted it in the hearts of humans by tricking themselves to think like God. In other words, these creatures are examples, not realities of things beyond the control of men. No man can truly conquer pride. Nor can he judge it in others, because he is guilty of it himself. This is the problem. And this is what God is saying to this man at the heart of this book. Can you adorn yourself with glory and majesty and honor and then come down and judge the pride of others? Can you bring low everyone who is haughty? Can you bring down everybody that you think is above you? Do you have the power to throw a fishhook into the nostrils of Leviathan? See it? This is not God pointing to real creatures and say, go tame them. This is God pointing to the most fundamental realities of the human situation, the fallen human reality, and saying, can you fix it? Like I said, first half of the speech is rhetorical questions about where you're around, so who do you think you are? But the second half is, okay, who do you think you are? Now, as I said a moment ago, it's not necessary here to comment on everything that God says about these creatures to get the point. I've already read, in fact, through the verses that I've read so far, I've already read most of the description of Behemoth, so I don't need to continue that. But let's just read a few more verses regarding this creature called Leviathan. 41, verse 8. Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. I love that. Go ahead, but you won't do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. Verse 12, I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shields shut up closely as with a seal. Down to verse 33. On earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of bride. The picture that God paints here in these two chapters of these two creatures are two creatures that look with great disdain upon puny humans. They look at us and laugh. Both are pictured as brutes of great strength and power, right? I mean, you see this imagery all throughout these two chapters of creatures that have great power, right? Go back to chapter 40, verse 18. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. Okay, so he's got this massive strength in his character, in his physical nature. He is of great strength. No one can capture him because of this great strength. Verse 24 of chapter 40. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? Again, the point being, no, he's too big to be captured. Can you put a rope in his nose? Verse 2 of 41. Can you put a rope in his nose? Right? Can you lasso him and drag him down and tie his feet together like you would a calf at a rodeo? Can you do that? The strength of these creatures, God says, is beyond the power of men, which is, again, why I think these are mythical beings. I think they're designed. God, I think, is painting a picture of something so profound, so great, mighty, that we wouldn't even dare think about the possibility of trying to bring him down. It'd be like, you know, you and I actually going out and visiting a real Godzilla and trying to throw a rope around his neck and bring him down, right? I mean, he's taller than a skyscraper. What are we going to do? I mean, they take their little helicopters and go shoot at him in Japanese subtitles. But they never take him down, or they try to take him down, and he still destroys them anyways, right? I mean, that's the point, that he's painting a picture here of creatures that are beyond our imagination. We might have imagined them in our minds, but they grow out of that into something far beyond. So God is purposely going into great detail regarding the physical abilities of these creatures, being muscular, being powerful, being unafraid of man or beast, and unrestrained even by human morality. Does Godzilla care how many buildings he knocks down? Does he care how many cars he crushes? Does he care that the insurance companies are running around going, ah! That's the first thing that comes to my mind when I'm watching these movies. I go, what are the insurance companies going to do with that? How do you write out the application for that? It's a building knocked down by a giant lizard. It's examples of that which is fundamentally beyond the power of humans. Because that is the point. God is putting Job in his place. Listen. You think you control things? You control nothing. You live in a physical world with forces that cannot be controlled by us at all. That, by the way, is the entire point of chapter 38, the beginning of this speech. You have no control over the force of gravity. You have no control over the forces that move anything. You cracked open the atom, but guess what? It was out of your control when you did it. You can't harness these forces. You can't control them. Again, an example of that which is fundamentally beyond our power. But another, of course, is Satan. He's beyond our power. He's more powerful than us. The scriptures make it very clear that he prowls around like a roaring lion seeking who he may devour. Why? Because he's a predator. And who is he preying on? Us! The evil cosmic powers of darkness all around us are beyond our control. As Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, our fight is not against flesh and blood. Our primal fight in this world is not against flesh and blood, but it's against powers and principalities and authorities in the heavenly places, evil forces all around us. We wonder why our culture has gone where the way it has, because evil forces have driven it there. Because this world is filled with devils. And when God lifts his hand of protection and restraint, human beings do these things because they're immediately taken over by these evil forces. Make no mistake about it. These are dark days spiritually. And we have no control over it. And not only that, not only are we, the power of the physical world is beyond us and the power of Satan is beyond us, but there is another force that's beyond us that we have no control over, and it is the worst of all, and it is death. Death stalks us. It stalks us. Malcolm McDowell, Star Trek, I forget the name of the picture. Every once in a while, Star Trek comes out with something good philosophically. Most of the time, it's garbage, but every once in a while. Malcolm McDowell said that. Death stalks us. You cannot escape it. It's coming. It's like a beast hunting you down, and it will catch you. It will get you. And it spreads to all without exception. None of us sitting here this morning think we're going to escape it, do we? Unless some of you believe the Lord's going to come before you die. Okay, maybe. But you know what? There have been people believing that for a very long time, and guess where they are? It stalks us, and we can't stop it. Oh, I know. It's only 7 days into January, and you're probably still keeping your resolutions. But going to Planet Fatness is not going to... Not my original, that's Rogers. But going to Planet Fatness is not going to make death one less inch away. It's not going to happen. You can't stop it. It's coming. And its teeth are bared. This is the point that God's making to Job. Come and stand before me and tell me how you're going to throw a rope around any of these things. And if you can, I'll gladly bow to you. I'll gladly stop and stand before you and say, you are God. Go back to chapter 41, verse 10. In the midst of describing Leviathan, here's what God says. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. No one is so fierce you dare to stir him up. Right? Let Godzilla alone. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. Who then can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? This is the key text that answers the implied question of chapter 40, verse 14. If you can clothe yourself in glory and honor and put down the proud, then I will accept you as God. Okay, if you can do that. Here's God's answer to that. Now, you will notice the similarity of that second phrase, who has first given to me that I should repay him, to Romans 11:35, who has given a gift to him that he might be repaid. Paul is probably quoting Job here in that passage. Now, I want you to remember something. I said this at the beginning. I'm going to say it again. God grants Job something. All right. I'll play your little game. I'll play along. You want to call yourself God? All right. I'll play along. I will acknowledge to you that you are something if you can do these things. Okay, so God grants him something. God says, fine, prove it. If you can bring down the proud, if you can bring down the powerful, I will acknowledge your sovereignty in the world. I will grant your wisdom if you can show to me your power to overcome the most fundamental sin embedded in the human heart and in the heart of Satan. Go ahead, show me that you can, and I'll acknowledge myself to you. So God grants him something. But through the course of Behemoth and Leviathan, God says, you don't have any real power, do you? You don't have any power. You don't have any power over these creatures, if they're real, even if they're real. I don't think they are, but even if they're real, you don't have any power over them. So how can you claim to have any power over any other force, including the forces of evil that are headed up by Satan? Now, do you see the point of this book? Now, do you see the point of this entire book? There it is, in a nutshell. Men are sovereign over nothing. God is sovereign over everything. You want to know why the book of Job is in your Bible? It's to make one point, and that's it right there. You have no power over anything, because God has power over everything. We are not gods. Oh, I know we think we are. We robe ourselves in little robes of glory and honor, which are nothing more than tattered, shredded bits of rags that someone drug out of their garage. We have zero power over the forces that threaten to undo us. We have no power over Satan's ability to destroy us. How easy was it for Satan to take down Job? Did it take any real effort on his part? When you read the first two chapters of this book, do you get the impression that Satan had to work really hard to destroy all of what Job had? Was it hard? No. Could Job stop it? Not in the least. It is foolish. Because we do not have such power, because we're not gods, it is foolish to assume that we have power over even more benign realities, like, say, our ability to choose him, God. Do we have that power? No. Thus, it was God, the Almighty One, the Omnipotent One, who purposed for Job to suffer. For whatever reasons he had chosen in his own sovereign counsel's decrees and purposes. Period. What reason is given by God in these two chapters? What reason is given in these two chapters for why Job suffered? Come on. I'll sit here and wait. None. Not one single time does God say, here's why you suffered. Nope. God just says, you suffer because I purposed it and you have no power over anything. God purposes for Satan to bring suffering to Job. It wasn't Satan's idea. It wasn't Satan's idea, was it? No. Have you considered my servant Job? Have you? Oh, you mean that guy you put a hedge around? It was not God's purposes for Satan to bring suffering to Job, not for Satan's delight. It wasn't so that Satan could gleefully attack Job. Oh, he might have had some glee in it. But to demonstrate that God's purposes will stand even where evil thinks it's in control. We look around at our culture and we think, man, is God still in control here? And the answer is, God is in control even where evil thinks it's in control. Satan may have slithered into that garden and wrapped himself around that tree and had a conversation with Eve, thinking that he had control of the situation. But God was watching and had purposed every word that came out of his mouth and everything that Eve did for his own purposes. Remember, it was God that declared Job was righteous. Remember, I've said many times now, have I not? And I hope this sticks with you, that God pointing to Job was not an observation. Have you considered my servant Job? That's not an observation. That's a declaration. That's God saying, this man is righteous because I have determined it to be so. It was God who declared Job to be righteous. And his purpose in that declaration is not thwarted by Satan's attack. God's purpose is not thwarted by Job's whining. God's purpose is not thwarted by Job's friends applying spurious logic to the reality of the situation, or any other force on earth or in heaven, real or unreal, including Behemoth and Leviathan. Nothing, absolutely nothing changes Job's position before God, because God had purposed it. Regardless of the circumstances. Brothers and sisters, keep that in mind. It's not about what happens around you. It's who you are. Thank you. So here's the deal. In the end, Job is forced, as we are, to trust that the sovereign God does all things according to a good and perfect plan. Doesn't often look it to us from our vantage point. From our point of view, it doesn't often look like it's a good plan, but it is. The suffering that comes into our lives doesn't look good, doesn't feel good, and we whine and complain and blame God and wonder if he still loves us. But God purposes it. And he will accomplish his purposes regardless of your whining or your complaining or Satan's plans or anything else. You see, my friends, listen, I said this before, but I'm going to say it again. The sovereignty of God, the idea of God being sovereign over everything, is not just some theological theory that we reform people gravitate to in order to be different. No. The sovereignty of God, knowing that God's purposes and plans from before the foundations of the world will be accomplished in time and space, is the solid foundation which underpins the gospel of salvation and everything else in life. We are forced by this book. By the time you get to the end of chapter 41, you're forced to stand there and go, you know what, God, you're right. I don't have a power over a single thing. And even the things I imagine get out of my control pretty quickly. I control nothing. I control none of the forces in this world. I do not control evil spiritual forces. I do not even control the moment of my own death. None of those things I have any control over. But you are the sovereign God. And that knowledge underpins a life of faith, a life of trust, a life of obedience, a life of turning and looking to God and saying, what would you have me to do? And his answer is, look to Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. That's what he said. Put down all of those things you think you're accomplishing, because you're accomplishing nothing. Put them down and come and stand before me with an empty hand of trust in me, and I will save you. That's his sovereignty. That's his power. No, we don't push the sovereignty of God as a Reformed church because it's like, that makes us cool, you know. No. We believe that the sovereignty of God is the underpinning of everything in life. That when the doctor tells me tomorrow that I'm going to be dead in 6 months, he hasn't said that. But if he would, if he did, then my duty is to walk knowing that God has purposed that for his glory to his end, and all that he does is good and right and perfect, even if it means me being dead. In other words, God grants us something. I said that a couple times in this sermon. Have you noticed it? God grants Job something in verse 14, right? All right, if you can, he grants us something. Instead of our own right hand saving us, God has granted us his sovereign grace to save us through the one that sits at his right hand. No, your right hand can't save you because your right hand is a power over everything. But his does. His right hand is the Lord Jesus Christ, who sits on the throne of glory at the right hand of the Father, who's been given all authority in heaven and on earth, who's been given the name above every name, who's been established as the one whose the earth is his footstool. He has the power to save. Whatever that might mean, however it might work out in our lives, but what must we do? Bow before his sovereign place. See? So when we come to the end of chapter 41 of this book, we come to the purpose of the book. You want to know why this book is in your Bible? It's not in this book to describe how to react to suffering, although it does tell us how to react to suffering, but that's not really its primary purpose. Its primary purpose in the end is to lay right before you this simple fact: God, the Almighty One, is sovereign. Period. End of sentence. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about that? We'll find out what Job does next.